here. It seems to be a very nice workshop. And the topic of the talk today, Dynamics of Modulated Wave Trains, is a project Bjorn Sandstede, Arne Schell, and Guido Schneider and I started up a couple of years ago. And in essence, many of the, at least the formal aspects of the things I'll be talking about today are already in the literature. What we added to this subject was a unifying approach in the setting of, for instance, reaction diffusion equations and, say, the mathematical validity of the things that have been derived, of the things you can derive. So in a certain sense, the major novel part of this work are the unifying approach and the mathematical validity, but I won't be giving too many details about the mathematical validity because I'll give the main theorems, but I won't go into the details of the proofs. I'd rather explain the approach and the things you can derive with it, and also I mentioned a number of applications. In a sense, this talk can be seen as a preparing the talk of Bjorn Sandstede on Monday, who in a sense took the next step of this we started this this work a couple of years ago, and Bjorn and Arne started to use these ideas to study defects in a more general setting. So, and also I'll be trying to give an introductory talk. So, the dynamics of modulated wave trains. What's a wave train? And I'll spend quite some time on the question, why do they appear in families? Which is a trivial question, but the way I answer it over here gives the idea how we apply the methods and how we will use the same techniques to eventually derive the Berg's equation that describes the modulation of modulated wave train. So I also have to introduce the idea of a modulated wave train, and I immediately bring it into the context of what you could call weak shocks in a Berger's context, or you could call it defects, and it's our special defects of certain of so-called sink type in the original underlying reaction diffusion equation. So to do the derivation, I first need to know something about the stability of the wave train, or at least I have to be able to formulate the say the relevant assumptions. So I study the stability of this wave train, and based on these ideas, I formulate a number of assumptions on the say the characteristics of the wave train. Then I spend quite some time on the ansatz. I think that's for me at least. Well, I have some training in deriving Ginzburg-Landau equations and things like that, but especially the ansatz is sometimes it's a mysterious thing that comes out of nowhere. And I would like to explain to you why this ansatz is the most natural ansatz you could take. And then you derive Berger's equation. Then I spend some time on validity. And then later I study Berger's equation. And I see the solution in Berger's equation, in a sense, imply shocks-like, defects-like structures in the full equation. And I study these things in the full equation again. And I end with a number of examples, but along the way I'll also be giving a number of examples. So, the first question, what is a wave train? Well, here's the reaction diffusion equation. It's in essence an n-dimensional vector, and an important thing is, do I have a pointer somewhere? No, I can point, use my finger, but well, it's okay. Oh, this is the electronic one. Okay. Well, the important thing is here that we take x one-dimensional. So we really only look in a one-dimensional spatial direction. So that's a simplification we're using today. So D is just a simple diffusion equation, a diffusion matrix, and the f of u is just, say, the nonlinear aspect of the system. What is a wave train? A wave train is just a very special kind of solution. I think I prefer to do it like this. It's a solution that depends on phi. It's 2 pi periodic in phi, and phi is omega t minus kx. So it's spatially periodic and temporally periodic, and you can see it's traveling with a certain speed. The speed is these omega, which will be our dispersion relation, divided by k. So that's how we define the phase speed of our traveling wave train. And this is just a simple picture of it. And I intentionally didn't draw it like sine-like because we intend to do this in general setting, so say far from equilibrium. So it's not necessarily something like a sine. It can be any spatially periodic structure that's traveling. So the claim is, and it's not a very deep claim as I already thought, but I think it's important to introduce this over here. In general, there will be a one parameter family of these wave trains, and the parameter is, say, the wave number. And the idea is very simple, but as I said, it gives a flavor of the methods we're going to use. The idea is that let's write down the equation for the wave train. So let's plug in U has this special structure with this 2 pi periodic phi in here. So you plug it into your equation, and you get a 2n-dimensional OEE in phi with periodic boundary conditions. K appears here as parameter, so the thing you can do is, if you want to solve this as a family in K, is you take the derivative with respect to the wave number. And I define my UK to be the derivative of U with respect to the wave number at a certain critical value K0, and the omega K is the derivative of the dispersion relation at a certain critical value K0. And if I just plug in, if I take the derivative in this equation, and I get a linear system, of course, and the linear operator L0 I get over here, that's the operator associated to the linear stability, of course. I mean, it's associated to the existence and to the linear stability of the wave, and I get an inhomogeneous term over here. The idea is, that's one of the fundamental assumptions in our approach. We assume that the kernel of this operator is one-dimensional, so it must be one-dimensional because it's the derivative of the wave is, that's the translation invariance, must be in the kernel. So the only thing we assume over here, that's the only element of the kernel, so the kernel is spent by the derivative of the wave, which is a very simple, a very natural assumption. So if you put this in, then the question is, can we solve this non-homogeneous problem? Well, of course you can solve it if you satisfy a solvability condition. So we define the adjoint of this operator, because this problem is in general not self-adjoint, and the adjoint has also a kernel that's spanned by U at one-dimensional, and we normalize the U at in such a way that the inner product over L2 of the derivative of the wave and U at is equal to zero. So we have to solve the problem L0 UK is equal to B, so we have this solvability condition that B must be perpendicular to the adjoint eigenvalue, which is, of course, something that's a trivial argument. So to have the existence of this solution du dk, I need to be able to solve this relation, because this was L UK is B, so B inner product U at must be zero. This tells me that this certainly can be solved if I take my omega k to be equal to this expression. This omega k, and it's one of the other reasons I decided to spend some time on this, this is the crucial property of my wave train, that's the group speed. So if the group speed is equal to this expression, I can solve the equation LU is B, so I can find this family of wave trains. And important over here is this that I have this identity for the group speed. So with this assumption, so the only assumption I plugged into my operator L0 is that the kernel is only spanned by the derivative of the wave, I know that there will be a family of wave trains, and this family is prescribed by this, say, nonlinear dispersion relation. Okay, so that's basic stuff, but as I said, I'd like to use this approach for the sequel of this talk. So let's do a simple example. This is a complex Ginzburg-Landau equation. Complex Ginzburg-Landau can also be seen as a reaction diffusion equation, and with the diffusion matrix is not completely diagonal, but it is not really important over here. The wave trains in complex Ginzburg-Landau are very simple. The wave trains can be written as pure exponential, so they are really like sines. And that's of course natural because Ginzburg-Landau is a near equilibrium theory. So the periodic solutions are almost like sines and cosines because you're close to the bifurcation in your underlying system for which you derive Ginzburg-Landau. So you plug this ansatz in and you get this nonlinear dispersion relation. Omega is a function of beta and alpha times k squared, where beta and alpha are the imaginary parts of my coefficients in the Ginzburg-Landau equation. So in what follows, we will eventually have the condition that the dispersion relation is not at least a second derivative, whatever. I mean, we need some non-zero condition on the dispersion relation. So in essence, what's following only applies to the complex Ginzburg-Landau equation, so with alpha and beta not equal to zero. But that's how the theory is set up. And an important remark in the Ginzburg-Landau context is what everybody, of course, knows, is such a wave train is stable if two conditions, 1 plus alpha beta must be positive, and k squared must be smaller than a certain critical value. And in the real Ginzburg-Landau setting, we get the famous k squared is smaller than 1 over 3. That's, I think, the Eckhaus stability criterion. But in general, this bend will shrink down as 1 plus alpha b approaches 0. But we have to assume that this expression is positive for stable wave trains, and k squared is smaller than this. So this is, say, a near equilibrium example. As I said, we would like to develop our theory, say, far from equilibrium also. So let's do an example far from equilibrium. And then, of course, the most natural system to study is Fitchuk-Nagumo, because it gives you a very natural example of traveling wave trains far from equilibrium. Well, there are a number of parameters. I don't want to go into the details of Fitchuk-Nagumo, but we know that there is a localized stable pulse traveling solution in Fitchuk-Nagumo equation. And it's already a relatively old result, or at least a couple of years old, by Stuart Hastings, that near, and it's also a very natural result, of course. I mean, if you write down the associated ODE, it's natural to see that close to the homoclinic solution, there must be a family of traveling pulse-like solutions. So in a schematic sketch, and of course it should be a three-dimensional sketch, but let's make it a two-dimensional projection. So in the W is in the y-axis and the U is the x-axis. Then the homoclinic orbit, so that's this traveling pulse solution, this is the traveling pulse of the Fitchuk-Nagumo equation, has, here's your critical point, you have a fast jump to, and this black cubic is, of course, given by this cubic expression over here. You have a slow part, you have a fast part, you have a slow part. So this is the traveling pulse in Fitchuk-Nagumo. And what you can do near this homoclinic orbit, you can construct periodic solutions that are close to, say, this little parallelogram spent by the pulse. And they travel with a certain speed, which is not equal to the speed of the wave train. And in essence, you can parametrize this family either by the speed or by the wavelength. But what you see is a traveling array of these types of Fitchuk-Nagumo pulses. So this is a far from equilibrium wave train, and this is also the kind of setting our theory will apply to. So a modulated wave train, well, what we're going to study is the dynamics of the full PDE, so the full, say, reaction diffusion equations near, or we'd like to study the dynamics in this family, but of course if you start with a modulated wave train, there's nobody who's forcing you to remain in this family of modulated wave trains. So we'd like to be in or near the family of traveling wave trains. And the most important thing, the outcome of the talk of today, is can we, for instance, construct solutions that are, say, really defect-like? So we have a certain wave train at minus infinity, and there is another type of wave train at plus infinity, and can we construct, say, heteroclinic orbits connecting the wave train at minus infinity to the wave train at plus infinity? Can we construct such orbits, and can we study their stability? And this is not, because it's a semi-2D sketch, but it's a better, to my opinion, overview to see what's happening. So here you have a small wavelength that's traveling with a certain speed, something happening in between, and out comes a larger wavelength that travels with another speed. And that's what we call the defect. Is it possible to construct these type of heteroclinic objects? And the answer will be yes, we can do something like that, but it crucially depends not on the phase speeds of you would imagine that the face speed is important. You have a face speed to the left and you have a face speed to the right. But it's not the face speed that is important. It's the group speed that tells you how things, whether you will see a wave train or not, or whether you'll see a defect or not. And remember, the phase speed was the dispersion relation divided by k, and the group speed is the derivative of the dispersion relation with respect to k. And the condition is that the phase speed at minus infinity must be larger than the phase speed at plus infinity, and the defect solution itself is traveling with a speed that's in between those two phase speeds. And that's why the physicist give this defect the name of a sink, because the way to get a feeling for the phase speed, or for the group speed, the group speed is in essence the speed by which perturbations travel. So a perturbation on the wave train to the left is traveling with the group speed with respect. So what you see in say an experimental setting, you see perturbations traveling into the defect, because it to the left it's traveling faster, and to the right is traveling, the perturbations are traveling slower, so you see information going into the defect. And that's why physicists call this a sink. And our theory tells us that we can construct a defect given this condition on the group speeds. So the first step is, study the dynamics within this family of modulated wave trains. So what we first need to do we need to have some information on the stability of this wave train. I mean, I didn't write down, I just assumed we have a wave train. And given this family of wave trains, how do you study the stability? Well, that's of course a well-known procedure. Here you have your PDE, you know you have a wave train that's depending on this 2 pi periodic function variable phi, so you're going to put your PDE in you're going to introduce, say, the traveling coordinate phi, so you write your PDE in t and phi, and you linearize around the wave train. It's all trivial standard techniques. So you get this linear equation, and the important thing is that the wave train itself comes in through the derivative of the nonlinearity, and you see this is 2 pi periodic in phi. So in essence, you will have a stability problem with a spatially periodic potential, and that means this most natural thing is to use Floquet theory, because Floquet theory tells you that you can decompose your U as a function, a product of a periodic 2 pi periodic function times an exponential, which is also periodic, and this new over here, which is our parameter, is supposed to be on IR. So this is really also periodic in phi. So this is what Floquet theory tells us. I can decompose my U in this form. So I can, and of course I also introduce the eigenvalue lambda over here. So I plug this into this equation and I get this linear stability problem, which is also all, say, relatively standard. The important thing to notice is for mu is equal to zero, so I'm looking for for completely periodic solutions, 2 pi periodic, then I get the operator L naught back, which I already saw for the existence problem. So now we had this assumption on L naught. We assumed that the kernel is spent by the derivative of the wave, and it's the only element of the kernel. And that tells us that, and that's the same argument as I used in the for the existence problem, that tells us that there is a curve of eigenvalues parametrized by this parameter nu that's for lambda near close to zero. And in essence, the same argument as in the existence theory, but in essence, it's following over here. So we know that this lambda is a function. So the eigenvalue is a function of my nu, which is purely imaginary, and this lambda is a function of nu, is what we call the linear dispersion relation. That's the dispersion relation that determines the stability of my wave train. And to see whether you get a family, you can use the same argument. You can, again, take the derivative with respect to nu and evaluate it at nu equals zero, and you know that at nu equal to zero, the solution to my stability problem is, again, the derivative of the wave. So it's exactly the same argument as we did for the existence problem, but now it's for the stability. But you see the derivatives, this is the derivative of the stability problem, this is the derivative in the existence problem, they are very similar. And if you apply the solvability condition to both, you can derive an expression for, the leading order approximation of your eigenvalue. So the leading order approximation of your eigenvalue for nu small, the derivative at nu zero is, if you apply the solvability conditions, you get that it's the difference between the phase speed and the group speed. So there's a very nice relation between, the existence theory and the stability theory. You can express all the information you want for the stability problem in terms of the existence problem. And this is the most simple one. This tells you only, the linear approximation of the eigenvalue. If you go on and you can take second derivatives and you just work kind of hard and you get similar relations between the second derivative of the eigenvalue, and you can express it in terms of the second derivative of the dispersion relation. So the essential information is we can express, important quantities in the stability analysis in terms of quantities for the existence analysis. Okay, so this transparency is a little bit a mess. But I think the most important information is what we get over here in these two pictures. What do we see over here? In essence, we see over here this curve, this eigenvalue as function of the parameter nu, which we introduced in the Floquet theory. And we can give it a quadratic, approximation. So the previous transparency, I did the linear approximation, but we can go one order further. And then we get a quadratic approximation. And then the local shape of this lambda as function of nu is, parabolic-like, and it's either to the left, so it's like the stable case, and it's when the second derivative in nu is positive, so that's a stable situation, or when the second derivative with respect to nu is negative, then you have an unstable situation. And then, of course, stable, that means at least locally, because this is only close to lambda is zero. So a couple of small remarks. The interesting case that's been studied most, I guess, is a transition from stable wave train to unstable wave train. So you go from here to there. And that happens when the parabola becomes flat. So you get a fourth order tangency, and you go from stable to unstable. So you go from stable through this one to unstable. And that's a so-called Eckhaus instability. So we're not going to go into the details of the Eckhaus instability, but that's how the Eckhaus stability comes in. So that's when the second derivative of lambda becomes zero. That's how you get, in general, the Eckhaus instability. Another remark is when the phase speed and the group speed are equal, this parabola collapses into just something on the real line, at least at leading order. Okay, so what's the assumption we have to put into our wave frame? Well, we have two assumptions. Important, generic examples, assumptions. First, we want to be in the stable case, so we want the second derivative of the lambda to be positive, and we also don't want to have a degenerate situation with the second derivative of the dispersion relation. We don't want it to be zero, and in a moment you see why we need this condition. So that means that we can do complex Ginzburg-Landau, but in essence we cannot, you have to adapt your methods to do real Ginzburg-Landau. And the next assumption is, of course, we want our wave train to be stable always. I mean, not only locally. So we want for any nu, not only close to zero, that the real part of lambda is negative. So that means that we don't want something like this. So here it's locally stable, but it turns back and it would become unstable here. But that's, of course, what we don't want. We only want to study stable wave trains. So we assume that for any nu, the real part of lambda is negative, except for the nus, of course, that are exactly at zero. Okay, this is a problem, by the way, that's very hard in practice. Given a wave train, for instance, I have a student working on Gehrer-Meinhardt, given a wave train, it's kind of hard. I mean, it's very hard to check this assumption. I think I didn't mention it, but Rob Gardner and his student, Edgardo Esther, did something like that for the Fitchuk-Nagumo case, for the traveling Fitchuk-Nagumo wave trains. But in general, it's a very hard question. A very hard problem to solve, but we assume here that it's been solved. Okay, so now we're going to look for modulated waves. A modulated wave train. So here we have our wave train. So this is a wave train, and a priori, I didn't mention that, you can always introduce a phase. This is the phase factor, this is just a constant. But now we're going to assume that this phase is allowed to evolve slowly, in such a way that the solution of the PDE remains, I would like to have it in the family of modulated waves, of wave trains, but of course it will be near the family. And this near and slowly are in essence artificial. So we introduce an artificial small parameter delta to be able to do, say, an asymptotic analysis. So slowly and close is going to say, well, we allow our k to move, to evolve, but only a little bit. So that's the slowly and that's the near aspect of this theory. So let's introduce this artificial small parameter delta and let's replace k by k plus delta in the wave train. So if I replace k with k plus delta in this setting, then we'll see, well, I get a nearby wave train, of course, but what's the character of this nearby wave train, say, seen from the perspective of the original wave train? So let's do a simple Taylor decomposition. So here, this is my dispersion relation. I can, of course, tailor it. The first leading order approximation gives me the group speed. There you see the derivative, so that's the important quantity, group speed again. And if you write it down in terms of your original wave train, you see the original component back again. This is the unperturbed case. And then you see at order delta, the component delta times x minus group speed times t. So this is the natural slow spatial coordinate for in this setting. And you see at order delta squared, you see t times something. So we have a natural slow time scale and a natural slow traveling spatial scale. So this little analysis tells me that the natural scales for my phase to evolve on is this slow time scale traveling with the group speed and this spatial scale and this even slower time scale. So that's why in the ansatz my phase will evolve in this way. And if my phase is evolving, I must be a little bit careful, because as soon as my phase starts to evolve, I will also be changing my k. So this is some little extra. So the change in the phase induces a change in the wave number. So let's just look at this little part. This is what we see in the structure of my modulated wave train. So I get the kx plus phi. So it's in essence what you see over here. This kx plus phi. If phi starts to evolve with respect to this x over here, so you just do a Taylor again, phi with respect to x, you see that in essence the k is changing to a k plus delta times phi x. So in essence what you see is that the k, by change of the phase, also your wave number changes. So your k becomes a k plus delta phi x. And that's, now we have enough information to give the full ansatz of our problem. The solution to the PDE is a traveling wave train with a slowly varying phase. So this is the phase depends on these slow x and slow t coordinates, which I explained on the previous transparency. And important over here is that when the phase is changing, also the wave number is changing in this way. Of course, this won't be a solution to the PDE. So we have to add some kind like a remainder term. This remainder term is order delta squared, and this we just put everything that's left over in this remainder term. And we take this ansatz and put this into the PDE. And when you put this into the PDE, and of course I'm not going to do it, I mean I've already done enough, technical details, but if you just do the DDT of u, you see that you immediately get at order delta squared, you get a derivative with respect to the slow time of your phase, and you get a derivative with twice the slow spatial variable over here at order delta squared. So you see these terms appearing in a natural way. So you plug this into the equation and you just start doing some bookkeeping. And as you've done all this, you get, well, at order delta you get your existence problem, or at order zero you get your existence problem. At order delta you get, say, the problem we solved for the when we showed that there is a family of traveling wave trains, this is identically equal to zero because we know that we choose the group speed exactly the correct value. So this is also satisfied, and order delta squared, we get a huge expression. I won't give you the details, but the most important thing is there is this operator L not again acting on this remainder term U2, and there is a lot of mess involving phi t, phi xx, and phi x squared. So this, when we want to have a solution to the PDE, we need to solve this equation. If you want to solve this equation, this expression should be perpendicular to the adjoint, to the eigenvalue problem of the adjoint operator. So we're going to take this solvability condition. Here it is, solvability condition. And now we have all these identities which relate the derivatives of the linear dispersion to the nonlinear dispersion, and you end up with this phase diffusion equation, which has, say, a diffusion coefficient given by the second derivative of the linear dispersion relation and a nonlinear coefficient given by the second derivative of the, this is the linear dispersion and this is the nonlinear dispersion relation. And the more well-known term is not write it in terms of the phase, but in terms of the derivative of the phase, so it's a wave number modulation, you get Burgers' equation. And now we can reinterpret our conditions on the second derivative of lambda and the second derivative of the nonlinear dispersion relation. Of course, we want this to be stable, so we want this to be, say, well posed. So this is positive. That means that we're looking for a stable wave. And we don't want this term to be not there. We want to have this term there at leading order. So that's why we wanted to have the second derivative to be not equal to zero. So here's the Burgers equation. And this is, as I said, I'll give a number of examples. In a number of example settings, this thing has already been derived by other authors. The things we added to it is this validity proof, which is quite technical. But, I mean, in essence, what we're saying is, if we have a solution to this Burgers equation that's in a certain natural sense bounded, and if we define associated to the solution of the Burgers equation its primitive, say, the phase, then we can define a solution to the full equation that is a wave train that evolves according to here this phase and here this q, then there exists a solution of the full problem that's, now, it's, as I said, it's very technical, but the most information you need, the information you need to get from this expression is that on the scale, that's on the 1 over delta squared scale of the Burgers equation, and on a spatial scale that's longer than the spatial scale of the Burgers equation, we have validity. We know we are close to a solution of the full problem. And of course, for instance, we would like to have validity on the entire real axis. But it's a very hard problem. I mean, this is a trivial sketch. But we try to approximate periodic structures. And you can do it on say, not too long intervals. But even when these periods are a little bit apart, very far away, these periodic solutions will really be order one apart. So that's, say, a simple argument why you cannot expect to have, in a result like this, you cannot expect to have, say, uniform validity on the entire real axis, and for a similar reason, you cannot expect to have uniform validity for all t. This is exactly the same situation as in Ginzburg-Landau, or very much, and also the techniques are pretty close to the things you do to the validity of Ginzburg-Landau. A simple other simple remark, if you just try to do Gronwall, you get validity, say, on an order 1 over delta time scale. But Burgers only starts to work on a 1 over delta squared time scale, so that's completely useless. So you have to do much more to get this validity result. Okay, let's now study the solutions to this equation. Of course, we all know, the front type solutions to the Burgers equation. Burgers equation is very simple. Depending on the sign of the second derivative of the nonlinear dispersion relation, so depending on the sign of this thing, if it's positive, then I have a front that connects, say, that goes from plus to minus. And if it's negative, I have a front that goes from minus to plus. And in Burgers, these things are, of course, nonlinearly asymptotically stable if you write down the good definition. And we're looking for stationary solutions in Burgers because we also have traveling solutions in Burgers, but we're already traveling anyway. So a traveling solution in a burger setting is just a stationary front in another when you do your analysis around a little bit different K. So by looking only at stationary fronts, you cover everything. And now this is a very technical slide again, and maybe I should just skip the details. I mean, what I'm doing over here is you start out, so depending on the sign of the second derivative of the dispersion relation, you either connect positive to negative or negative to positive. But the sign of the second derivative, of course, also tells you whether the waves, whether the group speed, because the group speed is the derivative of the dispersion relation. So when the second derivative is positive, the group speed is increasing.